Hello, shalom. My name is Nachum Amzel, and this podcast is What Does Judaism Say About? This is the full podcast. Today's topic is the Jewish view of human dignity. There is no controversy in Judaism regarding the concept of human dignity. It is universally regarded as an important idea, with the issues discussing only how important dignity is in the hierarchy of Jewish values and why it is so important. Indeed, it is vital to ascertain which Jewish values are less significant than human dignity and which are more important. The sources themselves reveal an attitude marked with great Jewish sensitivity and respect to each individual person. There is a general consensus, even among secular people, that it is somehow improper to insult another human being, to hurt his feelings or her feelings, or cause any psychological discomfort. Judaism similarly counts one of the 613 mitzvot commandments as an imperative to treat every person as one would treat himself or herself, to speak only positively about another person, and even to care about the monetary assets of that person and help them financially as much as possible, as much as the person would have helped himself or herself about his or her finances. This is based on the Mishnah, which instructs that a person is to treat another human being with the same dignity as he or she treats himself or herself. But when it comes to the reasons behind these generally held attitudes, it is there that secular society and Judaism part company. The Midrash says that each time you embarrass another human being, you are also diminishing God himself, the creator of that human being, who is created in God's image. Based on this concept, we can understand a series of Jewish laws which are very different from those found in secular society regarding the embarrassment of another person. For example, the second part of the Torah verse is perfectly understood and logical. Thou shalt not put a stumbling block before a blind person. One can readily comprehend that a stumbling block placed before a blind person, either literally or figuratively, will cause that blind person harm when he or she falls upon it. However, the first part of that verse, the first commandment says, you shall not curse a deaf person. Here, it is difficult to understand what kind of harm could possibly come to a deaf person who is cursed, since he or she will not hear the curse, no matter what, and no one will ever know or get hurt by this curse. Why is it prohibited? But if the reason for this prohibition is viewed in the context of the Midrash referred to earlier, it now can be readily understood. While the deaf person is not being harmed through the curse, the creator of that deaf person, God, and his image, is certainly diminished through that curse. By the same reasoning, Jewish law states that a person may not even curse himself or herself. On the surface, one may question why this should be forbidden in Judaism. One can easily understand why an individual may not make others feel bad. But why are you not allowed to harm yourself? But since you too are a creation of God, he is still diminished if you curse yourself. Even if you do not personally mind that curse, God, your creator, does mind. It is for that same reason that a person may not cause harm to his or her body. It really belongs to God, not to the individual. And even if the person does not mind, God, the true owner, does mind. This aspect of embarrassment will be explored more deeply later in this podcast. This reasoning that the embarrassment or hurt of an individual is prohibited because it also hurts God as creator, in no way minimizes the other reasons for this prohibition. Yes, it also causes pain to the person. Judaism certainly recognizes the severity of this component of the sin as well. A person who embarrasses another individual publicly loses his or her share in the world to come. This Mishnah is codified by Maimonides as part of Jewish law. Thus, while a murderer does not necessarily lose his or her share in the world to come, a person guilty of embarrassing others does lose his or her share in the world to come, demonstrating that embarrassing another person in a certain sense is more severe than murder. Clearly, Judaism looks upon psychological damage to a human being as even greater than physical damage. Why is the punishment for causing psychological pain more severe than that for causing physical pain, according to Jewish law? There are two reasons. First, physical pain can often heal and usually abates over time. Psychological pain of embarrassment, especially in public, can sometimes last forever and usually takes much longer to heal than physical pain, even if it heals at all. Second, psychological pain cannot be easily assuaged. While physical pain can often be reduced or even eliminated entirely through pain-killing drugs or eliminated through surgery, nothing the person says after publicly embarrassing another individual could possibly undo the damage. Apologies, even publicly, do not remove that pain. Both injured parties, the person who has been insulted, as well as God himself, are a necessary part of the tshuva repentance process in Judaism. Although a sinner has to repent to God for all sins, both those of man to man and those sins of man to God, the process of man-to-man tshuva is not complete even after one has done tshuva to God, until amends have been made to the injured party and forgiveness has been received from him or her. Thus, a person's hurt goes on even beyond the hurt felt by God and is a separate component of the sin of diminishing a person's dignity. This dual aspect of sin can be seen in a general philosophic argument between Ben Azai and Rabbi Akiva. In describing which verse encompasses the general and essential one principle of the Torah, Rabbi Akiva states that it is love your neighbor as yourself. Ben Azai, however, disagrees and states that the all-encompassing principle is, this is the story of humanity when God created the first human being in his image, a different verse than Rabbi Akiva. While Rabbi Akiva places the greater emphasis on the relationship between man and man, Ben Azai feels that the essence of how man should behave towards his fellow man is based on the concept that man is created in God's image. Both principles and verses are valid and not incompatible. Embarrassing another human being does violate both of these components. Since this mitzvah commandment is so important, I will show that both the Torah and the rabbis went to great lengths in order to preserve a person's dignity. The Talmud says that maintaining dignity is so important that one may even violate a negative mitzvah commandment for the sake of preserving that dignity. For example, later authorities rule that a person may violate any rabbinic but not biblical injunction rather than violate the individual's dignity. Since most of Jewish law is rabbinic and not biblical in nature, therefore most practices in Judaism can be violated if by fulfilling these Jewish laws, it would necessitate violating a person's dignity. When, for example, a Jew has to choose between fulfilling the commandment of reading the Megillah on Purim or burying the dead where no one else is available to bury the body, the Talmud inquires which takes precedence, the dignity of the human body even after death, or publicizing the miracle of Purim, fulfilling its Jewish law obligation. The Talmud clearly states that the human dignity of the dead, and of course of the living, takes precedence. The Talmud goes on to say that this mitzvah of burying the dead and not letting the body remain shamed and unburied is so important that even a high priest who may not willfully become impure by going to a cemetery in general, or even the grave of his closest relatives, must become impure and bury this stranger if he is the only person around. How much more so must Jews be sensitive to the dignity of those still alive? The Torah itself shows its sensitivity to the concept of not embarrassing anyone. One verse states that the place that the burnt offering is brought should be the same place in the temple that the sin offering for accidental sins is also brought. The Talmud explains that the Torah was trying to protect the identity of those who brought a sin offering, so that no one could tell by looking at a particular place in the temple if the people there were sinners or not. When the offerings of the first fruits, called Bikurim, were brought to the temple, a number of verses had to be read along with the offering of the first fruits. Since not everyone who is Jewish could read these words perfectly, the rabbis instituted a rule that there should be a permanent reader to read for everyone. It would not suffice merely to have readers for those who could not read, since their illiteracy would be obvious and highlighted by doing so. By having a permanent reader, no one would know who could and who could not read, avoiding embarrassment. This is the practice adopted today in most Ashkenazic synagogues regarding the Torah reading on Shabbat. In a similar manner today, since most Ashkenazic Jews cannot read the Torah with its proper melody, a Torah reader is designated to read for everyone, even those who can read the Torah, in order to avoid embarrassment for those who cannot. In the same way, it was the Jewish custom in earlier times to bring food to a shiva house, the house of mourning. However, the poor used to bring the food in plain baskets, while the rich brought in wealthier baskets, which caused embarrassment to the poor. Therefore, the rabbis institute the custom that everyone must bring food in a plain basket to the house of mourning. The rabbis, taking their cue from the Torah, instructed that the essence of prayer, the Amidah, must be a silent prayer, so that when people enumerated their personal sins in that prayer, they could not be overheard. Jewish law is often more sophisticated and sensitive than the courts of the 21st century. For example, one of the five categories of payment for damages was for the embarrassment caused to that person, based on a Torah verse. Even though the payment was subjective and according to strict tables of embarrassment, nevertheless, the Talmud states that even the lowest poor person was still paid significantly for embarrassment in damages, since he or she is a member of the Jewish people, automatically giving him or her stature and dignity. In another effort to protect the identity of the poor and not embarrass them, it was the custom on the 15th day of the month of Av for all the eligible young women to dress up and for the eligible bachelors to meet them. Since it would be embarrassing if the poor women put on their best clothes right next to the rich women who put on their best clothes, the edict was issued that all the girls would exchange their best dresses with each other so that no man would know who was poor and who was rich, avoiding any unnecessary embarrassment. On a daily level, the manner in which a person fulfills the mitzvah of tzedakah, Jewish charity, depends on maintaining the dignity of the poor person. The entire eight-step hierarchy of giving tzedakah, according to Maimonides' Rambam, depends on embarrassing the poor person as little as possible. That is why, in a traditional Jewish home, there is always a tzedakah box, where the money is given by the family, someone else collects the box, and then the money is distributed to a poor person, or poor people. In this way, the poor people never meet the people who gave the money and don't feel humiliated. That is why the highest level of giving tzedakah is giving the poor person a job or a loan. Why? Because there is no humility at all in receiving funds in the form of a loan or a job. The sensitivity in preserving a person's dignity in the synagogue can be seen in two separate instances, one which we follow in Jewish law and one we do not. If a person had a father who was known to be a terrible sinner and is an embarrassment to that son, and when that son is called up to the Torah, Jewish law says he should not be called up as the son of that sinner, since that would compromise his dignity, but rather he should be called up as the son of his grandfather. The second case involves the Torah reader mentioned earlier. In many synagogues today, Jews are very careful to make sure that every word is pronounced properly and exactly in order to fulfill the obligation to hear the words of the Torah portion. In order to fulfill the obligation and read the Torah properly according to Maimonides, the reader must repeat any error in reading, even a grammatical mistake, and he must return to the original place of the mistake and reread the verse. However, Tur brings another opinion based on the Manhig, who says that if a Torah reader makes a mistake, even if he mispronounced the word so terribly as substituting Aaron for Haran, which changes its meaning and pronunciation entirely, the congregation does not make him go back at all, because this would be undignified and embarrassing to him by calling attention to his poor reading. Although we do not follow this view today in Jewish law, this opinion indicates that care and dignity must be given to all public Jewish servants, and proper Jewish sensitivity, not to hurt someone's feelings, must always be taken into consideration. The Jewish view about those who do not retain dignity of another person is extremely severe. When the 24,000 students of Rabbi Akiva, who each was a great Torah scholar in his own right, to be a student of Rabbi Akiva, when they did not respect each other properly, they all died in a plague in 33 days because of this sin. The Talmud proves from the Torah story about Tamar and Judah that it is better to die in a furnace than embarrass someone. Tamar was willing to die rather than reveal publicly that her father-in-law Judah had sexual relations with her. This concept is further demonstrated in the Talmudic story in which Mar Ukva used to secretly supply food for a poor man by placing the food outside his door. One day, when the poor man sought to find out who was doing this great deed for him, and rather than be caught, which would embarrass the poor man, Mar Ukva immediately jumped into a furnace and burned his feet rather than be seen by the poor man. He later stated what we stated above, that it is indeed preferable to be burned in a furnace than embarrass anyone publicly. This comment in the story of Mar Ukva is not mere hyperbole, meant to let Jews know intellectually how serious this sin is. The Tosfot commentary rule that this is the actual Jewish law. They say that avoiding embarrassment indeed takes precedence over a person's life. And the only reason that this is not publicized as one of the big three commandments that a Jew dies for rather than violate is because human dignity and embarrassment are not specifically spelled out in the Torah. Nevertheless, Tosfot rules that preserving human dignity supersedes human life. Judaism is so sensitive to preserve a person's dignity that it goes out of its way to preserve the dignity of sinners, such as protecting the identity of those who brought the sin offering in the temple, and the institution of the silent prayer as noted above. However, other examples abound. When a person was a cold-blooded killer who was warned and then convicted by witnesses in a Jewish court, the Jewish court hanged this person. Nevertheless, even this person's dignity had to be preserved in killing him, as the Torah forbids hanging the body for too long as a sign of humiliation. A thief is obligated to pay back 4 times the value of a calf stolen, but 5 times the value of a larger animal stolen, such as an ox. When the Talmud asks why the different amounts, Rabbi Yochanan says that Judaism even cares about the dignity of that thief. Since he had to carry the calf on his shoulders, which is an undignified act, he pays only 4 times the value of the calf. But since the ox could walk under its own power, which is much more dignified, the thief pays back 5 times the amount. Even when sinners in the Torah had to be killed, they died, wherever possible, in a manner that would embarrass them least. According to one explanation in Rashi, on the verse about leaving Egypt, only 1/5 of the Jews in Egypt actually left there, while the other 4/5 were sinners and perished during the plague of darkness. It is believed that they died then and not later on, so that they would not be unnecessarily embarrassed to die publicly when everyone could see them and the Egyptians would be aware of their deaths. In a similar comment, when Moshe Moses requests for elders to help him rule. Rashi asks, where were the original elders who were in Egypt? He explains that they had sinned by partying irreverently at Mount Sinai and should have died right then and there. But God waited for many months until another plague was brought to kill other sinners, and the elders then died in that plague, so that they were not needlessly embarrassed in public, drawing attention specifically to them and their sin. Thus, the importance of maintaining a person's dignity in Judaism cannot be overstated. One commentary calls this quality of human dignity the most endearing and beloved quality in all of Judaism. Of all the blessings to choose to exalt another Talmudic scholar, one Torah sage blessed the other sage by praying, quote, "You should never cause anyone else embarrassment, and may you never be caused any embarrassment yourself." If only all Jews and non-Jews were to follow this dictum. Today, the very expression of a game known as dwarf tossing is almost completely unknown. But in the 1980s, this practice of throwing little people as a game or competition in bars was very popular. The people of short stature wore specially padded clothes or Velcro costumes and were thrown onto mattresses or at Velcro-coated walls. And these little people were very happy to participate since they made a lot of money. Participants competed to determine who could throw the dwarf the furthest. In the 2004 film Dodgeball, the comedy cites a magazine called Obscure Sports Quarterly featuring midget tossing. But this sport is not mere fantasy. It was a very popular activity, especially in the New York City bar scenes in the 1980s and 1990s. But what is a topic like this, dwarf tossing, doing in a book about Jewish values? Apparently, because it was a popular sport, and many little people could not get other serious work, they willingly participated because it provided them with a sizable income. If they voluntarily took part in the activity, was there any moral problem in doing so? The ethical issues involved in the act of dwarf tossing, as it was called, is highly degrading to little people. The question then is, if a person willingly degrades himself for a paycheck or any other reason, should society and Judaism allow him or her to do so? Efforts were exerted to ban this activity specifically because it is humiliating, even if the little people involved were willing and active participants. As far back as 1990, the governor of New York, Mario Cuomo, signed a bill banning dwarf tossing, but the law limited the ban only to bars serving alcohol. In Ontario, Canada, the Dwarf Tossing Ban Act was introduced by MPP Sandra Pupatello in 2003, but this private member's public bill did not even proceed beyond its introduction or to its second or third readings, nor did it receive royal assent, and therefore died at the close of the 37th legislature. On September 27, 2002, the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights judged that the decision was not discriminatory with respect to little people. It ruled that the ban on dwarf tossing was not abusive, but necessary to protect public order, including considerations of human dignity. Nevertheless, dwarf tossing is not prohibited outright in France. It is true that the Conseil d'État decided that a public authority could use gross infringement on human dignity as a motive in order to cancel a spectacle, and that dwarf tossing constitutes such a gross infringement, but no law was ever enacted. What does Judaism believe about this or any other activity which clearly abuses human dignity? Even the willing little people participants are certainly not proud of what they do, but the people being abused do not mind the humiliation if they are paid well. There are two main ethical, moral, and legal issues in Judaism concerning an activity such as this one. One is the question of whether a person is allowed to intentionally harm himself or allow others to harm him. The other question is whether a human being has an ethical right to demean himself or herself. Before discussing the ethics of degrading oneself from a Jewish perspective, the first issue that needs to be addressed is if a Jew may intentionally physically harm himself or herself. It seems to be a dry Jewish law question, but there are actually many Jewish values involved in investigating this issue. And in the final analysis, Jewish law in this area is not so clear-cut. When the Torah allows Noah, after the flood, to eat meat for the first time, until that time, man was commanded to be a vegetarian. The verse says that man can spill the blood of an animal, but not spill the blood of a human being. Rashi comments on this verse that not only can a person not spill a human being's blood, i.e. kill him or her, but we may not spill even our own blood. This not only refers to the prohibition of suicide, but even to literally spill one's own blood by intentionally hurting oneself. Rashi makes this comment as if this prohibition is a foregone conclusion. But this issue is actually an argument between two rabbis in the Mishnah. Rabbi Elazar says that it is permitted for a person to harm himself, while Rabbi Eliezer HaKapar says it is forbidden, since a person may not even deny himself any enjoyment in the world. Thus, the pain caused by hurting oneself would indeed be forbidden. On this Talmudic passage, Meiri commentary says, this sin of harming oneself is only rabbinically forbidden, but not prohibited by the Torah. Maimonides seems to agree with this view, citing a case where a Jew makes an oath that he will not harm himself, and Maimonides then rules that this oath is valid. It is an established Jewish law that any oath that prohibits an action that is already forbidden to a Jew because the Torah forbade it, it is an invalid oath. Thus, the fact that Maimonides considers this oath to be valid proves that this law of not harming oneself is not a Torah law, but only prohibited by the rabbis. A commentary on Maimonides explains this concept and clearly says that the prohibition of harming oneself is rabbinic and not biblical. Nevertheless, when forbidden rabbinically or by the Torah, Maimonides very clearly rules that it is forbidden and prohibited for any Jew to harm his or her body intentionally. This applies to minors or adults, men or women. Just as it is prohibited for a person to harm someone else's body and cause injury, it is likewise forbidden to damage one's own body. Based on this ruling, it should be clear that a little person may not have his body intentionally damaged, even for money, and that dwarf tossing would indeed be forbidden as well in Judaism for the customers in the bar who intentionally throw the little person and cause damage to her body, but even the little person himself or herself. After discussing whether a person has the right to physically harm himself or herself intentionally, another crucial issue to be analyzed is whether a person can intentionally perform an act which is clearly undignified to himself, merely because he or she wants to. Can a person decide to humiliate himself if he or she desires to do so? If a person is not psychologically hurting anyone but himself, is there anything morally wrong with self-degradation? Although many people might argue that morally each person has the right to do what he or she wants, as long as it does not injure or offend someone else, would Judaism agree with this premise? Is there any Jewish value which prevents someone from degrading himself or herself? On the surface, it seems that a person can indeed humiliate himself if he wants to do so. The Torah tells the Jew to love his fellow man as much as he loves himself. If a Jew does not love himself, it seems that he should be able to dislike someone as much as he dislikes himself. In a similar manner, the Mishnah states that a friend's dignity or honor should be the same as one's personal dignity or honor, implying that it is certainly permitted for a person to desist from honoring himself. Moreover, Avot Rabbi Natan seems even clearer. If a person does not want others to dishonor him, then he or she should not dishonor others. If a person does not want others to speak badly about him, he should not speak badly about others. Thus, the clear implication is that if a person does not care about his or her own honor or dignity, it might be permitted to dishonor others. In fact, the Talmud discusses this very question. May a person renounce his honor or his dignity? After a long discussion about a king, Maimonides rules that a king may not renounce his dignity because the office must be respected regardless of the person. But it seems that this law is only in regard to a Jewish king because of that office. It seems that every other kind of Jew can indeed renounce his or her honor. Thus, while a king's honor must be preserved, the Talmud states that a Nasi president or head of a rabbinic college may indeed renounce his honor. Even parents may renounce their honor regarding their child. But a rabbi may not renounce his dignity because of the holiness of the Torah, which the rabbi represents. Later authorities in Jewish law did confirm that a parent may indeed renounce his or her dignity or honor. Based on all of the above, it seems clear that a little person who wants to humiliate himself or herself may indeed do so. And yet, this Jewish idea is not so clear-cut. In explaining the ruling of the Tur regarding who is permitted and who is forbidden to renounce his honor, Rabbi Yosef Karo specifically differentiates between the Hebrew word discussed until now, kavod, which we have translated as honor or dignity, and the Hebrew word bizayon, which is translated as humiliation. Kavod is the positive honor that people usually bestow upon good people, great people, parents, elected officials, and rabbis. It is that positive honor that is debated in the Talmud, i.e., whether each individual may legally relinquish it or not regarding himself or herself. But even if these symbols of honor may be renounced, it is never permitted in Judaism to humiliate any of these people. In fact, no human being may ever be humiliated at all, no matter what his status of life or death. As cited above, the Mishnah says that anyone who humiliates any other human being in public loses his or her share in the world to come. This includes not humiliating a rabbi, a president, a parent, or any human being. The expression for humiliation in the Talmud in modern-day Hebrew is malbin pinei chavero, to whiten someone else's face. Because when a person is embarrassed or humiliated, the blood rushes out from that face, leaving a person looking very pale. Maimonides codifies this idea and rules that someone who humiliates or embarrasses someone publicly indeed loses his share in the world to come. The seriousness of the sin of humiliating others was demonstrated above. Humiliating oneself seems to be no less forbidden and no less serious. Therefore, the prohibition against humiliating oneself has nothing to do with the question whether you can renounce your honor. Just as it is forbidden for the dwarf to curse himself because cursing oneself also humiliates God, so too it is forbidden for that dwarf or little person to humiliate himself or herself. In addition to the degradation of that human being, the humiliation also degradates God, the creator of that little person. No matter how much a person may claim to the contrary, every person certainly feels degraded when she or he is used as an object to be thrown in a bar. Thus, while people may choose to forgo their honor, they can never decide to forgo their dignity. Humiliating oneself, even for money, would be forbidden in Judaism as an act that disrespects both the person and God. Thank you for listening and giving of your time. If you would like to respond or react to any of the points discussed, feel free to write on the group Facebook page, What Does Judaism Say About?, or more privately by email at whatdoesjudaismsayabout@gmail.com. That's one word, whatdoesjudaismsayabout@gmail.com. In addition, if you would like to receive a full transcript of this podcast, feel free to email me. Please subscribe to the weekly podcast so that you will not miss even one topic. Shalom.